Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Karen C. Kim. Dr. Kim is a graduate of Stanford University School of Medicine, where she received her medical degree in 2005. Her postgraduate training was at the Cleveland Clinic Digestive Disease Institute in the Department of Gastroenterology and Hepatology. She is currently in practice as a staff physician in the Department of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Guthrie Clinic in Ithaca and Robert Packer Hospital in Sayre, Pennsylvania. We'll be talking to Dr. Kim about her journey into medicine, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tish.
Now, what was it prompted you to get into medicine in the first place? Did you feel it was a calling, or did you think of it as just a career at first?
Completely not a calling. You know, everyone in my family thought I was going to go to law school because I was the big mouth of the family, very opinionated. And in fact, in college, I didn't major in biology. I was a women's studies major. I had lots of things that I thought I might do in life. But it was actually when I did a study abroad program. Actually, when I was in college, we didn't have a formal study abroad program, so I decided to take a leave of absence. I had taken a class in African history and was really fascinated. This is in 97, just a few years after Nelson Mandela was elected. And I decided to take a leave of absence and go. And I think back to it, I think, wow, I was 20 years old and I just dropped everything and went. And I think at the time, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was going on, and I had some interest in international human rights and law, and I met with a number of people who were working with NGOs and USAID, and I think after the time that I spent there, it was almost a full year that I was there, I think I decided that a lot of what I saw, with all due respect to everyone out there, I wanted to be able to do something was much more tangible. And at the time, HIV was sort of starting to get on people's radar, and obviously they had epidemic levels. And I started to think, you know, health is something extremely concrete. Doesn't matter what your political persuasion is. It doesn't matter what color your skin is. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It's something that everybody needs and understands. And so that sounds so corny because I do not come from a family of any doctors. But that was sort of the calling, the wake up, like, oh, there's many, many things I can do in my life. But this is something that feels extremely concrete.
Wow, and I don't think that's
corny
at all.
It's a very roundabout sort of journey. And then I, you know, I had taken a couple of pre-med classes. I decided to then apply to medical school. And I really have felt that my non-science background has served me far greater in medicine than might otherwise be expected.
Oh, I can imagine. Yes, of course. We want doctors to be well-rounded and know about the rest of real life, right? Mm-hmm. So how did you get into gastroenterology? I mean, that's a specific, really intense discipline.
I went into medical school thinking I wanted to be a pediatrician. I mean, I think it's really hard when you don't come from a medical family and you have not had a lot of experience with the healthcare system to know what fields there are. And so if you're a kid and you've grown up, the only doctor maybe you've seen, and you're healthy, maybe the only doctor you've seen is a pediatrician. So maybe the reason I thought that was because that was really all I knew. But when I was in medical school, it's very interesting because what you think you're going to love is so different from what you actually love when you do it. Uh-huh. And so my best rotations, really interestingly enough, the first 2 years of medical school are classroom-based, at least the traditional medical school. And then the second 2 years are clinical rotations, where you spend 1 or 2 months immersed in a field. So internal medicine, a lot of that is in the hospital taking care of inpatients, or general surgery, where you're rounding with a surgical team and scrubbing into cases and saying you're really immersed in it, although you're mostly observational. They let you do a few things, but you don't get to do too much. Mm-hmm. And I hated pediatrics. I really hated it. I just did not enjoy it. And, you know, I feel bad saying that because I think it's such an important field. It was kids coughing, getting sick, parents. It was, you know, things that I couldn't change that would annoy me. And I think with adults can make their own bad decisions. But when an adult makes a bad decision for a child, it's extremely frustrating to see.
Yes.
So it was really more that. And I found it extremely difficult to see critically ill kids. I don't know why. It just affected me much more than I otherwise expected. So ironically, my two best rotations in medical school were general surgery and psychiatry. And I often joke that GI is the marriage of psychiatry. psychiatry and general surgery. So I love the procedural aspect of general surgery. And then psychiatry, I think there's a lot with, obviously, behavior, but also lifestyle, and then also, obviously, clear biology.
And it affects people's bodies. We think our bodies and minds are separate, and our behaviors are separate from our wellness.
And GI had never really been on my radar until I was on an internal medicine rotation. So GI is a subspecialty of internal medicine. Uh-huh. And I was on my internal medicine rotation, and I got, as a medical student, you have the luxury of following a patient from beginning to end. I followed this gentleman at the VA. I was on the rotation at the Palo Alto VA, and there was a gentleman who, I think he was in his 60s and had terrible diarrhea to the point where he had to be hospitalized for it. And I went down with him to his colonoscopy. I didn't even know what a colonoscopy was, I think, at the time. And I thought it was really cool. Some people either have a visceral reaction, this is disgusting. Some people have a visceral reaction, wow, this is really cool. And that was my reaction. And the doctor who was there was very, very, very kind and said, here, take the scope. I want you to try this and feel what it feels like. And it ended up being a very, very rare case of something called eosinophilic gastroenteritis. It's very, very rare, unusual. It's like a one in a million sort of a case. And so we wrote it up. And so it was just kind of neat to see. And then we saw him get better.
Ah.
and that was sort of where I got interested in GI, because
that
it was something so universal.
Little kids made you run, but you were able to do colonoscopy.
Right.
Well, we might have to explore this.
Yeah, right. I know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about gastroenterology, because it encompasses so many things. You know, I mean, ulcers and esophageal cancer. And one thing that I do want to talk to you about is pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. You hear about it more and more. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for that? Do you have any idea? Is it diets, environmental?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah,
probably worth more than
I hear
more
about
than
people dying from that more than I ever did in the last 20 years.
And I think, you know, I don't know that the incidence is necessarily rising. It's that of a lot of the different cancers that we see, such as breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, it is the one cancer where we've essentially made almost no headway in terms of early screening, so therefore early treatment and potentially prevention, and that we have no better treatments than we did 20 years ago.
And the treatments are horrendous.
Horrendous.
That Whipple, where they cut open the whole
abdomen. It's an incredibly invasive, it's like the surgery, right? You have so much taken out. And then the chemotherapy and radiation treatments are, they really have not changed. I mean, I know that there are some new treatments, but the amount that they've extended life has been pretty slim. So that is, I think it's just that while we've made a lot of progress in other cancers, we're not making any progress in pancreas.
I've actually noticed that. Well, what's your favorite part of gastroenterology? Is it doing colonoscopy still?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because
I know you're in hepatology too, so the liver is a fascinating organ as well.
So what you said before is exactly what I love about it, which is that it actually encompasses many different things. I have patients who, when I'm about to start their screening colonoscopy, turn around and look at me and say, why on earth did you get into this field? And then I try to tell them, I don't just do colonoscopies all day.
Exactly.
I mean, if that was all I did, then it wouldn't be very interesting at all. But what I love about it is it's very multidisciplinary. I'm not just looking at patients that I'm diagnosing with cancer. There's a lot of autoimmune disease. So there's ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, which we think are immune dysregulation diseases. There's celiac disease, which is an autoimmune phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's autoimmune hepatitis. There are so many different organs that are involved, from the mouth, as I like to say, to the other end. And then all the digestive organs in between. I love hepatology because there's a lot of internal medicine there. It's very concrete. It's viral, but it's also, I feel like I get to exercise a lot of different intellectual sort of stimuli.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole psych component as well, which I believe very strongly, and I think people forget. How many of us stress eat? Like everyone. And, you know, how many doctors spend time talking to people about what they eat? Very few.
I was going to bring that up.
So I actually feel like I can bring a lot of the things that are important to me, which is, what are you eating? What do you do every day? How does your stress affect your life? And that very much plays a role into my practice and what my patients experience. So I feel like I get to marry all those different things. There's this clearly medical intellectual side, but then it's very multidisciplinary. But then there is the psych component that I think is extremely and environmental and situational and environmental.
So you seem to like the mystery of it and the puzzle of trying to figure all that stuff out. That's really interesting to me. When I decided to have you on and I started looking into what gastroenterology really encompasses, and it's amazing. It's the whole functioning innards, you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
It's amazing. Let's talk a little bit about women in medicine. I know you're more recent than some of the people I've met. In regard to when you went to medical school and so on, what was your journey like? Is there still a lot of sexism? I know more and more women are getting into the field.
Sure. So, it was funny. I was just at a women physicians gathering not too long ago, and some of the older women, it's fascinating to hear their experiences, because many of them were like the first in their class, or certainly one of my colleagues was telling me how she was pregnant in medical school and she was the first pregnant woman ever in their medical school. They didn't know what to do with her.
Wow.
So women are much more prevalent in medicine, but there are still fields that are predominantly male, and GI is actually one of them. So although that is, I think, very rapidly changing. I think the sexism that I've experienced is not so much that it was overt. It was more the systemic and systematic sexism. I really loved general surgery. And I often think about the fact that part of the reason I didn't do it was I was a little scared off, and I'm sort of ashamed to say that, but it's a brutal training. I mean, it is truly brutal, and it's also long. It's like 7 years of brutal training, and I have to be honest and say I just was like, how am I going to do that? I wish it wasn't like that. My own training, I did 3 years of internal medicine. It was rough. I was pregnant for my last year of training, and I don't want to make a sob story, because I think a lot of women do this, and a lot of women do this in many other fields. But it wasn't easy. I remember having morning sickness and on ICU rounds, and I would run to the bathroom to heave into a toilet and then run back. And there's also the bravado of not trying to show any weakness.
Oh, yeah.
So I was definitely part and parcel of that. When I finished my internal medicine residency, I started my fellowship training with a 9-week-old newborn.
Wow.
And I had made this big deal of, I'm not going to ask for any special favors. I have a 9-week-old, but I am not asking for any special favors. I'm going to show that I can do anything that any guy can do. And, I remember when I started working, there were just the little things that made my life very difficult. And I wasn't in a position to ask for changes. So let me give you a concrete example. First thing, my program director said to me, "You what? You have a 9-week-old?" And then he told me a couple months later, I thought for sure you were going to quit immediately. Like, the assumption is, why would you work if you had a child? And then there was no place where I was nursing. There's no place where I could pump.
Ah.
So I didn't have a private office. I shared a room with 12 other people. And so I would have to find a room where I could pump. And I remember carrying my big black bag with me around on rounds. I mean, sometimes rounds would take 8 hours. And finally, one of my attendings looked at me and said, "Karen, what is that black bag that you're carrying around?" And I said, I could try to be very discreet about this, or I'm going to educate this 60-year-old man on what this black bag is. I said, "This is my breast pump. I'm carrying around my breast pump because there's one lactation room in this ginormous hospital that takes me 20 minutes to walk to."
God, that's amazing. So you're telling me in some ways women have not been accommodated. Remember, it took years for women in the Senate to get their own bathrooms, for instance.
It's exactly like that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Karen Kim. We're talking about her journey as an MD and a gastroenterologist and hepatologist, and she works at the Robert Packer Hospital and the Guthrie Clinic in Ithaca. And let's continue our conversation about this.
Sure.
About the challenges of women in medicine are still prevalent. I'm shocked to hear this, since you're a recent doctor.
Yeah, I think it may not necessarily be unique to medicine. I think it's something that maybe we see in a lot of the professions that are extremely demanding of time. And that's really how do you juggle everything else. I often joke, and it's really sort of in some ways inappropriate, but I often joke to my husband, like, I want my own stay-at-home wife. Because
I've heard other professional women
because
say
it's sort of plays into the sexism of that, what's inherent in that statement. But there are a lot of women who are professionals who, for better or for worse, are married to other professionals.
Exactly.
And it's the juggling of that. And in medicine, I think because there are such time pressures, and I understand them. You know, when I was in training, you have to do a certain number of hours. You have to see a certain number of patients. You have to do a certain number of procedures to be competent. There's a lot of discussion about work hours and what's humane and what will prevent mistakes. But there is also a lot to be said, now I'm starting to sound old school, for actually seeing the evolution of disease, which you can't see when you only do an 8-hour shift.
Yeah.
And the passing of the buck when you are, it's a very fine line between taking care of people and making sure that they're not going to make mistakes with lack of sleep, and also continuity of care and missing things with shift work, so that's inherent to when you're passing 20 patients on to another person. There's no way to communicate. So
I want to ask you this too. Do you think the fact that there are more women in the professions and in some of the disciplines, has it changed the environment and the culture?
I think it has. I think it's slow, but I think it's changing. And I think I actually, you know, among my friends that I went to college with, medicine, ironically, once you're done with the horrific training, has been one of the more accommodating fields for women who choose to work part-time. Mm. I may not work part-time my whole career, but for the time that I have young children, you know, my employer was incredibly, surprisingly, accommodating of my requests. And that was a little bit surprising. I remember talking to a pediatrician when I was in training. She lived across the street from us, and she said, I was complaining about how difficult it was, and she said, yes, but you know what, Karen, my friends who are corporate lawyers and my friends who work on Wall Street, there is no part-time option, whereas as a physician, you do have the option of working part-time, and that's an unusual thing, you know, in a number of professions. Yeah, so I am grateful for
that. And we have a shortage, especially of GPs and primary care physicians in this country. I want to talk to you. Let's go back to what you were talking about in regard to nutrition. This is a question I've asked many medical people, medical professionals, people who've been patients. Why don't people know more about nutrition in the medical fields? Because it seems to be the essence of what the problem is with so many people.
So I have to be careful because I didn't do additional training in nutrition. For me, a lot of what I think about in terms of food may not necessarily be based on hard evidence and, you know, studies and so on and so forth. I think that for one thing, one of the reasons why people don't understand a lot about nutrition is because of the food industry. I also think it's because our lifestyles have become such that convenience is so important. And then there's been the erosion of prepackaged food and convenience foods, I think, are a huge part of the American diet that may not be a part of the, you know, diets in Europe or Asia or whatever. And that may be, there are many, I think, geopolitical reasons behind that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In terms of why the medical profession, I don't know. I think it takes time for a general practice provider to sit down and talk to somebody and say, Tish, tell me what you eat. Tell me what you drink. Let's start from the time you wake up. I do that for a number of my patients simply because it can reveal a tremendous amount of information.
Yeah.
It gives me some idea, are they food insecure? Are they, oh, you're drinking a 6-pack of Mountain Dew a day. You might want to be aware of what caffeine does. Or, oh, you drink 3 pots of coffee a day. Guess what? Coffee is both a diuretic and a laxative. That might help explain your diarrhea.
Yeah,
but it's remarkable to me how a lot of people don't, you know, we don't take the time to think about what we're ingesting and how it might be affecting our bodies.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it's not part of, I think it's sort of like the same way we treat mental health.
Yeah, I'm absolutely mystified. And you know, I mean, even the food industry has tried to get the FDA and so on, have tried to get people to read labels. Still, people don't know that there's 12 teaspoons of sugar in a Coke.
Absolutely.
And things like that. And there's sugar in spaghetti sauce and all these things
that
they would never think have sugar in them. It worries me. I'm not some saint. I have my bad
habits. Absolutely, and you know, actually, we should all be really afraid because you know, with the obesity epidemic, it's not just that, oh, we can't fit into our size 4 jeans anymore. It's really what this has in terms of long-term ramifications for healthcare in this country. There's all this talk about cost containment. Mm-hmm. But are we focusing enough resources on preventing people from having all of these chronic long-term diseases such as diabetes, such as cardiac disease, as renal failure? And that's going to cost us a hell of a lot more if we don't invest into some of those preventive efforts.
And it affects the whole culture, too. Absolutely. It's not even just health. It's the entire culture.
Like, there's childhood obesity, that's something we should be really afraid of. Yeah. And that a lot of that comes down to what we're allowing our children to eat.
It's amazing to me. Let's talk about the state of healthcare while we're on it.
Oh, dear.
Well, you know, just a little bit. I mean, you've been in the profession for a while. So do you feel like the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, as it's really known, has made any kind of a difference in regard to delivering services to people
Sure.
who need healthcare?
So, unfortunately, I think Obamacare, I actually prefer to call it like the Affordable Care Act. I feel like Obamacare is sort of inflammatory. I think it's become so politicized, it's like you're either for it, and you're probably a Democrat, and you're either against it, and you're probably a Republican. I wish it were quite so, it were simple. I think the most important thing it did was provide access to care for so many people, and there's so much misinformation about that. People who are like, I hate this Obamacare. I'm like, well, you wouldn't have had insurance if it wasn't for Obamacare.
A lot of people don't know that the Affordable Care Act is Obamacare, talking about people staying
exactly.
ignorant about everything.
Right.
It's so sad.
I think what a lot of people didn't realize is it gave them access to care that they had no access to before. That being said, was it perfect? Absolutely not. There were a lot of problems with it. There were skyrocketing costs. There were insurance companies leaving the exchanges because they weren't cost effective. I think they underestimated how many people who would join the exchanges or get coverage who were sick.
Yeah.
And because you couldn't discriminate on the basis of a pre-existing condition, which is a good thing, you ended up self-selecting for people who were ill. Because the cost ramifications or the tax implications for not taking insurance, if you're a young, healthy person, like my brother is a freelance artist in New York City. He's 20, you know, when he was in his 20s. He's in his early 30s, very healthy. Like, why would he? It was in his better interest
to pay
the tax penalty than it was for him, because a lot of the plans that were being offered in the exchange were extraordinarily expensive. You know, $300-$400 a month for a single healthy male. So that is also understandable. And they also had, some of them had extremely high deductibles. So while, in my opinion, something was better than nothing, for many people, that something that was not good, they didn't realize was still better than nothing.
And I also think people didn't realize that there were so many people who were uninsured.
Yes.
And the reason why they were so ill is because they couldn't afford to go see a physician ever, you know?
And
it's a vicious cycle in this
country.
And they
were utilizing the emergency room,
exactly.
basically. So a lot of hospitals were in very perilous financial positions because many of them, you can't turn somebody away. Somebody who is, you know, extremely sick, shows up in your emergency room, you have to take care of them. Doesn't mean they're up, and if they didn't have insurance, it doesn't mean that they will ever pay you for all of those services.
Yeah.
So a lot of hospitals were eating the costs.
I know you say that you only work part-time right now, but are you constantly having to keep up with what's happening in your field and reading books and taking special classes? And
sure.
How much time does that take out of your life as well?
Well, so we have to maintain what's called continuing medical education credits. Some people are grandfathered into what's considered the previous You only had to take your board exams once and then you were done.
Ah.
But I am not in that. I am not grandfathered into that. I have to recertify every 10 years, and I recertify in both internal medicine and gastroenterology. So I will retake those boards, and then I have to fulfill a certain number of credits every year. It's also, I think, hard not to try to keep up because fields like hepatitis, so I treat hepatitis C, and that is a field that has changed completely since the time I even graduated from my fellowship.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a sea change in terms of the shift in treatment. So I have no choice but to keep up because there are a lot of diseases I treat where the treatments are not fabulous, and so constantly looking for better and newer treatments. Hep C was really a sea change. If only we could contain those costs.
Exactly. Now, tell us what your expectations when you started getting into medical school and deciding to become a physician. How different was it now that you're a practicing doctor? What has surprised you?
So I think when I was in medical school, I still was that extremely idealistic, and I'd like to think I still am, you know, progressive. I had started a class when I was in medical school. It was an elective called Physicians for Social Responsibility, and we would have a different lecturer. It was a 10-week class. We had a different lecturer from the community. And I sort of imagined myself like, living in Africa in some mud hut practicing. And obviously that's not the case. So that is one thing that is different is my life as I imagined it. It's very different from my life now. But the training does sort of brutalize you in the sense that you do lose, you know, I hadn't read a novel in many, months, and that's not normal for me. Uh-huh. Things that I loved, I hadn't done. So when I was done with my training, there was quite a bit of bitterness. Yes. I said, I will never encourage any young person to go into medicine. Now that I'm 6 years out, I feel very, very differently. I feel very humbled by my patients. And I feel very, I'm reminded on a daily basis, it's a privilege for me to be able to do what I do. And somebody even pays me for it. Mm. Whereas when I first got out, there's this sense of entitlement. Like, I worked really hard and, you know, why do I have to deal with this? And I don't feel that way anymore. I feel very privileged to do what I do and that somebody actually gives me a paycheck for it. And I know that there's a lot of burnout and cynicism in medicine, but I think some of the best doctors I know are still people who have that wonder, that sense of wonder, that sense of intellectual interest, and who still feel really strongly committed to, I am taking care of people at their most vulnerable. Yeah. And that sometimes, I feel like it's a little bit of a swing. You got to start out with that humanistic bent. It gets a little bit, you know, beaten out of you, and then it comes back.
I was thinking that you probably felt a little bitterness because you couldn't read, and you wanted to, you know, like what you said in the early part of the interview about how you wanted to bring some of these other aspects of yourself into this discipline, and you can't do that if all you're doing is medicine, right? You want to be able to have a horizon.
When 80 hours of your week are spent, exactly. It's tough to have the other stuff.
We only have 2 minutes left.
Sure.
So would you tell people to go into medicine, and what would you advise for a young person thinking about going into medicine and becoming a physician of some sort?
I would tell them to not think of it as a tunnel that you're trying to come out on the other end. You have to think of it as a journey. You still live your life along that journey, and that you can't think about choosing your specialty or choosing anything based on how much money you're going to make at the end, because guess what? That changes. Mm-hmm. You have to do what you love and do it because you love it, and then keep that sort of sight or that goal in mind. And the rest works itself out. If you do what you love, it all works out.
Yeah, great advice. I've been talking to Dr. Karen Kim, and I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for
having
me.
Yes, and keep up the great work. I think you're probably a really great doctor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.